Well, good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Michael Dermody. Welcome to this session, Weather and Carbon Derivatives, presented by John Tyndall. There's a paper supporting this presentation, which I'm sure you've all read. John's background: John is a consultant with Finity Consulting based in Sydney. He has previously held positions with Milliman, JP Morgan and QBE, all based in Sydney. John received a Bachelor of Science Honours degree, majoring in Pure Mathematics, and also has a Bachelor of Engineering in Civil Engineering from Sydney University. He's completed a Graduate Diploma in Applied Finance and Investments at Finsia, and he has significant experience in the pricing of commercial and personal insurance risks, as well as in the pricing and hedging of financial derivatives, particular weather, index and alternative risk transfer products. John has published several papers and articles in the technical risk management area, including swaps and swaptions. That was his thesis for the Bachelor of Science, weather derivative pricing and risk management applications, managing the weather, which was published in Actuary Australia in August 2008, and counting carbon, Actuary Australia, in October 2009. So without further ado, I'll hand over to John.
Thanks, Michael, for that lengthy introduction. I didn't know I'd done that much, but welcome, everyone. So today, as you can tell, I'm going to talk about... Well, I guess I probably should reverse that. I have second thoughts. I'm going to concentrate on the alternative risk transfer market in the first part of my talk, and then particularly focus in on weather and carbon contracts, which are something I have particular interest in. So I'll give a background of the market and I guess try and define the market as much as it can be done. It's a very difficult market to define, and it's something that's very dynamic, and from year to year the types of contracts that fall into and out of the art definition constantly changes. So it's a difficult area to confine, but I'll try and do that. And then I'll go a little bit more in depth into both weather and emission or carbon markets, as it's more commonly referred to. I guess I should probably explain part of the reason of joining these weather and carbon contracts, and at least the risk management and pricing issues of them together. The concepts, as we'll see a little bit later when I talk about the pricing principles, are very similar. And that's primarily due to the fact that they're very incomplete markets. They haven't existed for very long. Volumes are volatile. Prices are volatile. There generally isn't an underlying security with which to hedge these types of derivative contracts, so it makes the pricing of them, the theoretical pricing of them, more difficult. So the types of techniques you tend to develop to price these contracts are very similar, and they're based around, from a theoretical point of view, they're based around variations to common frameworks, such as the Black-Scholes framework. And on a numerical side, they use typical techniques such as Monte Carlo analysis or Byrne analysis. So the types of issues you get with incomplete markets are something that sort of brings the weather and carbon contract worlds together. I'll look a little bit at the pricing principles, and by that I mean some of the mathematics behind it, but I'll skip over that fairly quickly. And I'll skip over a few slides, actually. If you visit the website after this, the presentation's a little bit longer than what I'll give here today, but I'll try and cover the important and interesting points. I'll look a little bit more into an example of how you apply these principles, and we'll just look at a basic temperature contract. So we'll look at modelling temperature here in Sydney and Melbourne, and then how we'd price a contract based around temperature. And try and then talk about, given enough time, some of the issues that you need to consider in the risk management applications of these. Once you've priced it, how do you deliver these types of structures to the market, and the types of structures that are in demand at the moment. So alternative risk transfer... It covers a wide range of products and carriers, and in essence, it covers non-traditional risks that can't be traditionally placed with reinsurers or insurance markets that exist for commoditised type products. And that can vary from industry to industry. It's not solely a general insurance or a life insurance market. It covers, and often contracts will coalesce parts of both markets within the same structure. I mentioned self-insurance and captives there because they were really how the market began back in the, really early 80s. It was a means for companies to circumvent the normal practices in terms of self-insuring your risks, and they started developing captives in terms of being able to self-insure a lot of the risks they faced. From my understanding, a lot of this came about in the UK because of the practice at the time of not allowing the discounting of reserves, and by circumventing the insurance market and putting it onto financial markets, where you were allowed to discount liabilities, then they managed to create a benefit out of that. But of course, the contract had to be structured as a financial markets contract rather than an insurance contract. And we'll look at a couple of the differences between that a little bit later. Swiss Re, who are, I don't work for them, never have, but they'll come up a few times in this talk because they're probably, amongst the two major European reinsurers, they're probably at the forefront of the art market in terms of the volume of contracts that they execute or that they have a hand in. So one of the most accepted definitions of, or splits, I guess, of the art market is one that was proposed by Swiss Re in a paper they did probably 5 or 6 years ago, which is this break into the alternative carriers and the alternative products. The alternative carriers is particularly talking about the self-insurance and the captives that I mentioned and what still constitutes about 70 or 80% of the market. The alternative products, on the other hand, refer to, in particular, what I'll be talking about today. So products that transfer risks between these people, between these organisations, but are not situated as a internally to these organisations. So in terms of that, they require brokers and counterparties is, I guess, the essential difference. But that's a convenient split because it enables you to understand the different drivers of the types of products that are issued. And as I say, the alternative carriers side of the alternative risk transfer market is quite well developed and has existed since the early 80s, whereas the alternative products were really born out of, I guess, probably cat bonds would come to mind as probably the first instance of alternative products and securitisations coming to the market. And that probably wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s that cat bonds and weather instruments in particular took off. So focusing on the second classification, the alternative products, I've just listed a couple of types of products that you'd generally see in the market. And anecdotally, one of the first securitisations took place in 1988, which was just securitising the profits that emerged from a block of life policies. And that's quite a popular mechanism nowadays. In fact, you're starting to see in Europe, securitisation of other insurance profits, even motor portfolios and the like, where you have a relatively stable emergence of profits on the portfolio. I'll briefly touch on probably all of them, and they're actually not separate. They're, I guess, securitized risks covers them all, but the reason they're split out is I guess, in terms of the development of those respective markets. And emission and carbon derivatives being left the last there, it's really a very immature market, and as we'll see with some of the charts we look at with carbon prices that have been experienced in Europe, it's extremely volatile, subject to political risk and other regulatory decisions, I guess. Why art? I mentioned that they were originally conceived to circumvent either a regulatory problem or an accounting treatment that was unfavourable in insurance or reinsurance markets. That was the impetus for it, but I guess it quickly grew to realise that the capital-bearing capacity of financial markets is thousands of times larger than the capacity of reinsurance and insurance markets, and it enabled a mechanism in times when premiums were spiking, after catastrophes, when you get common reinsurance premiums spiking. It was a way of, I guess being able to tone down those spikes by accessing alternative forms of capital. And often after significant catastrophes, you have a drying up of the capital in the traditional reinsurance and insurance markets. And this really provided a way of again, circumventing that and accessing capital at a rate that wasn't affected by these one-off spikes in premiums. And anecdotally, it has gone a long way to reducing the premium spikes that you see after significant catastrophes. And the volumes of transactions you see in art markets are very dependent on how long since the recent catastrophes have occurred. For example, after Hurricane Andrew and the Northbridge earthquake, there was a massive interest in alternative risk products, which waned towards the end of last century. Again, after September 11th, we had another spike in reinsurance premiums, and alternative risk products suddenly were back in favour, and the volume of them picked up significantly. Once again, we had a fairly benign few years for catastrophes, sort of, I guess, you know, 2003 onwards, and fell out of favour to a degree. And we'll see that in some of the charts we'll look at on volumes of these types of transactions shortly. Why else? That's the historical reasons for delving into the art markets, but I think these days there's a real convergence of insurance and financial markets, and this is all part of a sort of comprehensive ERM practices that you see a lot of companies integrating. There is an understanding that there are many ways to transfer risk in the modern world, and that these types of contracts have benefits and sit as a diversification within your portfolio. And I guess that exists both from the people who are seeking to transfer the risk and the people who are accepting the risk. So these products have really accelerated in popularity, and there have been several funds that have, you know, been dedicated to this market that have cropped up over the last 5 years, such as Filia and Fermat and Securus, and they've all been developed specifically to invest in these types of structures due to the unique diversification benefits that they produce. Now, I haven't actually included it here, but in the paper there's a little summary of a hypothetical weather transaction based on the data that I use here, and it tries to look at the correlation of that between other asset indices such as the S&P 500, the ASX 200, and shows that there's a negligible correlation between those two. This is on a daily return basis. And this has really driven a demand for these products, which has waned in the last couple of years since the GFC, but it really produced a large interest from hedge funds and other specialist asset managers in terms of being able to provide this portfolio diversification, rather than having to scour the globe for 10 or 15 diversified portfolios. They can pretty much go to one place and diversify their entire equity exposure with one structure. And again, just at the end there, I just recap on I guess the two most important reasons that people would invest in, that companies would seek to use art contracts as transferring risk rather than engaging traditional reinsurance and insurance contracts. And that's to receive a favourable, different, you would only do it for favourable accounting treatment, and to access a broader capital pool, which will hopefully give you a better rate. So let's look at, just going to quickly look at a few of the sections of the weather market, and then we'll briefly look at the carbon market. The purpose of this slide is... I'll go to the next one. So the purpose of this slide is just to... The cap bonds were really the instigator of the securitised insurance market, and have been the... have seen a resurgence in use in the last two or three years, with issues particularly covering earthquake and windstorm now becoming quite popular. as mentioned, that they were born out of the capacity constraints that existed in the 1990s, and anecdotally back in the 80s, there after the inflation rates burst, there was some capacity constraints around due to these earthquake and Hurricane Andrew in 1992, and these contracts were developed at that stage to access a broader market pool. Significantly hit by the GFC fallout and new issues dried up. I think there was probably only $500 million of new issues in 2009, which is probably about a tenth of what had been issued in previous years before that. Still about $10 billion in outstanding capacity out there, and so that sort of, I guess, sees the market through, and there's a secondary market involved in trading those. But it definitely, the new issues, it completely dried up, and it was largely based around the Lehman Brothers being a counterparty to several of those cap bonds that were issued, and I'll look at that in a little bit more detail here. So, as we all know, Lehman failed, was that mid-2008? They had sponsored four major cap bonds that were in the market. So I say there the TRS counterparty, that's a total return swap counterparty that exists, I guess, in between the two sides of the contract. And they were considered approximately to be risk-free. Lehman's at that stage was a major financial institution in the United States, and was considered amongst the other counterparties that existed on these contracts, were considered to be close to risk-free. Of course, that was proven not to be the case, and the types of structures that are generally involved in these securitisations to protect you from this sort of occurrence failed as well. So I briefly mentioned there the capital backing and the collateralisations that exist to protect you if your counterparty fails. They also failed, and that was due to the types of instruments that they were invested in. So two of the cap bonds failed, and the other two were downgraded to a junk status, which meant that everyone had to liquidate their holdings of those bonds. So those bonds never recovered in price, and really scared a lot of issuers away. And really, it's only been in the first few months of this year that they've been willing to accept the US financial institutions as counterparties to these transactions. And a lot revolves around improving the types of asset backings or capital backings or collateralizations that exist on these. And this is a daily type of a daily account of the exposure and a collateralization on a daily basis to minimize the effect of any individual failure. So it definitely spooked the market. And remained so for all throughout 2009. I guess we were significantly lucky that there was a large outstanding issuance of cap bonds, and that there's a decent secondary market in them, and that enables the trading and that enables the volumes to be maintained, and it enables new entrants to be able to gain access to the market, even though new issues aren't being put onto the market. So the response to that is that the requirements for, I mentioned they're multi-party collateralisations or US Treasury debt. So a lot of the assets that were used to back these contracts suffered from correlations to other assets that Lehman owned, and I guess they owned assets that were significantly correlated to the performance of other banks, and they were collateralised risks in themselves. And of course, once they got downgraded, they were liquidated from their holdings, and that they received a lower weight in terms of how much was required to back the contracts, and that meant that the backing of these contracts reduced to about 60% of what was supposed to be collateralised, which meant there was a 40% shortfall, which caused the failure of those two bonds. I guess I'll probably, before I jump to talk about weather derivatives. In between, I guess I'll talk about insurance-linked securities in general, of which a cat bond is a type. They've received a lot of negative connotations coming out of the GFC, being blamed as, I guess, securitised CDOs, whatever you want to call it, have been partially blamed for a lot of the problems that existed. And, you know, in some respects, that's warranted. It caused a massive sell down of these types of assets amongst the major financial institutions, and actually caused them to be distributed on a much wider basis. They're actually probably 80% of the market was held by probably the four or five major institutions, two reinsurers and three major banks. And now that's a lot more diversified, I guess, is one of the upsides of the downfall of the securitised market on a global basis, is that these things found their way into more hands and have been diversified across the globe slightly. So I guess that's one positive that's come out of the recent market turbulence. On the positive side, there's some real signs of growth this year. There's been three or four cat bonds issued earlier this year. Aon Benfield, who are one of the major brokers in this area, are predicting about $10 billion of new issuance this year, which contributes to the market significantly. It will be 20 times what occurred in 2009. We've even had some cat bonds issued here. I think Swiss Re back in 2006 issued an earthquake bond called Australis, covering Australian risks. So the market has taken a severe hit, but it seems to be getting some of the traction back that existed in the boom year, which was 2006, and which is also represented here. This graph in particular talks about the weather derivatives market, which is a subsection of the ILS market. This shows the massive boom in it. I mean, it had a significant increase. It was really only began in the late 1990s, and it was a market that was nearly single-handedly developed by Enron. And I guess my chart picks up here of just after the fall of Enron, and shows that it had been growing quite significantly in decent trend for 4 or 5 years, and peaked in 2006. And this was primarily to do with the massive hedge fund interest when equity markets were going out of control upwards. Hedge funds were seeking for more and more. I guess they had more and more funds. The funds under management were growing so large that they had more and more capacity to invest in these types of alternative assets. And many of these assets were what led to their downfall in the later years. So it had an unnatural spike, you could say, in 2006. The risks associated with these contracts weren't very well understood. A lot of funds were getting into these contracts based on evidence that you could get superior returns from these contracts and minimise or lower your risk profile. But they didn't really do their own due diligence on the types of products they're investing in and how well they fit into the asset profile that these corporations had at the time. So 07, 08 and 09 have been pretty poor years. But compared to 04 and 05, not too bad. You know, it seems to have stabilised. It seems to have... That we also are complicated by the changes in definitions around weather derivative contracts that occurred on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is the majority of the trading that exists. They occurred in 2007 and 8 and changing from weekly to monthly contracts basis. But apart from that, it seems like the markets managed to stabilise after the peak in 2006. And once I say again, anecdotally, this survey doesn't get updated. I think it's actually probably hitting the press now and it comes out around June. So we'll see what happened in the last 12 months. So that's the 12 months to May. But anecdotally, it's recovered significantly, and volumes will be in line at least with 2009. So carbon markets, the types of, a bit of background. We've all heard of Kyoto Protocol, and I guess that was the catalyst for carbon markets to develop worldwide. The Kyoto Protocol has a number of mechanisms that I mentioned here, which together, allow for the distribution of credits to flow around the world in an organised fashion so that the best use, the most economic use of CO2 emissions is obtained. So it incentivises people to, where they are efficient users of CO2, to use their limit, and where you are not efficient users to offload that limit for a price. And the types of mechanisms we talk about are really just designed to transfer these credits, if you like, between developed and developing countries, what they call Annex 1 countries and non-Annex 1 countries. But I guess significantly the Kyoto Protocol and more importantly the Australian, adoption of what's described in the protocol is very uncertain. We all know from the political announcements recently that we're not going to see any type of carbon trading mechanism for at least another couple of years. But then again, we're probably not ready for it this year. There's still a lot to learn, and as we'll see here, the European Union's got the most established trading scheme in the world, and they've encountered some issues with that in recent months that give food for thought, but also a highlight that you need to be careful when you're developing these types of mechanisms. They can be abused quite easily, like any financial market can be abused, and that abuse isn't limited to the general market participants, so it affects everyone in essence. So it was a UN developed protocol in 1997 in Kyoto in Japan. I just note there we've got 136 people who have signed and ratified it, and there's only one, we all know, the US, who's remaining, and they've got about 34 or 35% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So that's really all that's outstanding in terms of getting the signatories. I should be correct. They've signed it, but they don't intend to ratify it, and I don't really know what the difference is. But that's a technical a technical definition, I think, there, which basically means that they like the principles, they understand the problem, but they're not going to do anything about it right now. The flexibility mechanisms, there's three of them. I guess probably the first and the third are what I'll talk about a little bit today. So the IET is this emissions trading. So we're all referring to it as an ETS. I guess an ETS is something that exists within a particular country, and it's the trading of certificates amongst companies and organisations within that country. So within Australia, all the companies will be given caps, and then to the extent that they're under those caps, they'll have some certificates that they can sell on the market to other Australian companies. But then there's an international version of that ETS, which then can distribute these emissions amongst Annex 1 countries. So Annex 1 countries are roughly the developed nations and some that are in transition. So that means non-Annex 1 countries are pretty much the developing nations. Joint implementation. There hasn't been a lot of JI projects. They're within Annex 1 countries. They're harder to prove their sort of financial viability. I mentioned there the biosequestration and geosequestration. I mean, you see there's been a few attempts at it, but there's certain benchmarks that you need to prove in terms of getting these projects registered, and it just doesn't stack up as financially in a financial sense, as well as the CDMs or the Clean Development Mechanisms. And these are projects which are implemented in non-Annex 1 countries. So these are going into the Philippines and improving the waste disposal of a rubber plant or something like that. And you need to prove that... you need to scientifically and financially prove that the the reduction in the greenhouse gases can be certified, and that goes through a process that's been developed by the UN. And at that stage, you get issued a certified emission reduction unit, which is a CER, which is something that's traded globally, and there's significant trading of CERs on the European exchanges at the current time. So they're the three mechanisms. It's basically we want to provide a cap to everyone on the types of emissions that they can use, and then we have these three underlying mechanisms by which we can allow these to be properly distributed around the globe. And of course, the cap by itself does nothing because it doesn't allow you to find the best use for your CO2 emissions. The way that trading is established amongst the companies and the organisations within a jurisdiction enables them to get the most efficient use out of the CO2 emissions. So these are a couple of the scandals that I mentioned that earlier this year, which kind of rocked the European markets. The European markets have been going since about 2005, so it's fairly well established, and they've had a couple of hiccups on the way. Of course, prices collapsed, as we'll see a little bit later at the after the financial crisis. But that was to do with the liquidity of the markets. I guess recently there's been a couple of issues that have come out in terms of the security of these types of certificates and the and I guess the transparency and the accounting measures that are utilised within each of these countries. At a basic level, each country needs to account for the emissions within that country, and to the extent that a certificate's been used within that country to offset emissions, it can't then be sold onto a global market and used by another country, which is the recycled CER scandal, which occurred just a few months ago. The second one there, the Hungarian government had already, companies within Hungary had already used 2 million certificates to offset their emissions, and the Hungarian government on-sold these onto the market, onto the international market, unaware that they had already been used to offset emissions within their own country. So that caused a suspension of trading on all the European exchanges, or on most European exchanges, and for I think 2 days even, and of course, created havoc, and the volatility resulting from that incident is only just starting to abate. The first one was about a month before that, and this was, stolen inverted commas. I'm not sure. I guess they were falsified documents. They're certificates, so they're electronic, and a series of criminals, if you can call them that, had accessed the company's details and enabled them to create fake certificates, which they scoured the globe to thousands and thousands of companies. I think they only got one or two out of every 400 companies they approached who said, yes, we'll buy one. But companies, even as companies in Australia, were approached on this, they managed to falsify these certificates from these six German organisations and on-sell them 250,000 permits. It's not a huge amount of permits, but I guess the implications for this type of scam, caused massive volatility in the markets and dried up volumes about 40% from the corresponding month the year prior. So I'll talk a little bit now about modelling and pricing these types of contracts, or these types of variables, I guess we should say. The contracts, particularly with carbon and weather contracts, they're very closely linked, so often these contracts will involve components of both. For example, a company in Australia, an energy company, its weather is significantly impacts the amount of energy or electricity they're going to need to supply to the grid on any particular day. And this also, obviously, significantly impacts the amount of certificates they're going to need at the end of the day. So if they're pumping more energy into the network, they're going to need more certificates. So the types of contracts that are starting to emerge in Europe are ones that link both weather and carbon variables and allow you to hedge both of those risks to the extent that they're correlated within the same structure. Pricing these things, there's, I guess, two philosophies, an analytic approach, if you like, a Black-Scholes assumptions. Black-Scholes doesn't work, particularly with weather variables, because you don't have an underlying contract with which you can hedge the risk, and so you can't strictly follow the Black-Scholes framework. The log normal distribution is totally inadequate for most of these types of returns, but again, these are limiting assumptions, and a few authors have suggested ways of overcoming these, and one of the examples that I'll give shortly compares a modified or an alternative Black-Scholes framework to other numerical methods that are sort of more commonly used in the actuarial space. But I guess summarising what I'm trying to say here is that traditional derivative pricing techniques don't apply to the weather market, but also to the carbon market, due to the short history we have of returns and to some of the political impacts and other types of risks associated with carbon markets. Simply a country adopting or not adopting the Kyoto Protocol has significant impact on prices, and you don't tend to see that in other general equity markets. So you tend to need to put jumps into your models, jump diffusion models, to try and account for these types of movements in prices. I won't stop here for long. A GHD, these distributions just fit the tail a little bit better. They're starting to become more popular, particularly with carbon returns, because of these jumps. They can capture those jumps a little bit more accurately than a log normal distribution. And I mentioned here briefly the Black 76 model, because that's instrumental in pricing both carbon and weather futures. When you try and synthesise an underlying, so you base the derivative on the futures price, which now allows you to remove the time dependence of it. So that's a common model, a common variation to the Black-Scholes framework, but is particularly useful in pricing weather and carbon contracts. So I'll get to that in a little bit more detail later. Analytic solutions, and I'm going to run through both in my example shortly. Generally don't exist. You have problems with the types of assumptions surrounding the frame, as you always do with the Black-Scholes framework, but it's particularly acute in weather and carbon markets. Numerical solutions, I guess we're all pretty familiar with them from our studies. You can take a parametric or non-parametric approach. You can have something where you specify the distribution, or you can have something where you just purely fit to the historical data. And they're relatively easy to perform, and I guess the normal practice in the market at the moment, given appropriate computing power that's available. These numerical methods are burn analysis, the traditional actuarial approach. What would have happened if I did this 50, each year for the last 50 years? Discount that. What have I got? Monte Carlo simulations. Well, we've got to assume a distribution here, so it's a little bit more restrictive than the burn analysis, but it's a little bit more tractable in terms of being able to explain the types of results. I guess a burn analysis is, this is the number, whereas a Monte Carlo simulation, given that you've parameterised it in a particular way, the results are a little bit more tractable. And then there's the alternative Black-Scholes, which I briefly mentioned before. This is just tweaking slightly, and this mathematics isn't important, but it just shows you that basing it on the futures price tweaks the Black-Scholes framework slightly, and you end up with a slightly different partial differential equation. And what I've just tried to boil it down to there at the bottom is that it's if you consider the basic Black-Scholes vanilla option formula to be the BS with the four variables in there, which would normally be Y and T and R and sigma, it's having this adjustment, so basing it not on the underlying spot price but basing on the futures price, really just discounts that value back to time zero and removes the interest rate from the from the Black-Scholes form. So it's in effect basing it on the futures price, which is taking the time value of money into account already. You don't have the growth of the asset over time involved in the equation anymore. So how do we go about using? We need to have an understanding of the temperature or the carbon price. We need to have a distribution of that price, and we need to particularly remove all the non-stationary effects from that, so we can do a proper time series analysis, so we can understand the distributions of those, and obviously the end game in all of these things before you can decide on an appropriate distribution is to look at your residuals, and if they look all right, then you've got a distribution that you're happy with and you can go on with the pricing process. But most of the work is trying to determine that appropriate distribution. So you'll detrend the data, look at the seasonal fluctuations, remove all the trending you can to try and get down to a stationary process. I'll quickly go through some of the components of this. And what I've done in the example that follows is to remove the seasonal and the linear components. It's just a simple Fourier series there. It's only first order. That's generally enough to capture the processes. And you can see there's a linear term on the front there to incorporate the general increases in temperature over time. Mean reversion, we're all familiar with this. Interest rate variables in particular, but weather variables also. I mean, they can't keep rising or falling without bound. You don't get temperatures rising up and up every day. They have to return to a mean, and obviously that mean changes over time. So there's a seasonality in that mean. This is something that's also been found heavily in carbon markets also. When you have mean reversion, you need to modify your Brownian motion process, and it's called an Ornstein-Umbeck process, and you've probably all seen this once again in interest rate questions and markets. So it's really just the first term in front of the DT there that changes, and you've got that term there to represent the being pulled back to the mean at every step by a particular factor, which I've described as an integrating factor approach there to be able to turn that into an equation which we can use to predict this process, to project this process. And so it just boils down to being able to estimate the parameters in that last equation. What happens when we do that for Sydney and Melbourne? So here's a couple of distributions of Sydney and Melbourne temperatures. You can see they're bimodal, which means you basically need to split it into two before you can get a proper understanding. You can see that the distributions are significantly different, and they're not two cities that are a long way apart. They are north and south of each other, but the significant change in distribution as you change in latitude means that you generally need to involve the latitude in your distribution, the latitude of the site you're investigating in your distribution. So we'll generally split these into two, and here's a rough split of the summer and the winter months. And you can see once you split them into two, you're starting to get some distributions that we can get our head around. It's nearly looking log normal in Melbourne. It's not far off normal, particularly in summer for Sydney. But this just highlights the differences you can get between these distributions based on the location. So we'll split it into the locations, and then we'll split it into some groups or buckets, and it happens to be summer or winter. It's not strictly summer or winter. They're sort of inverted commas. They're just the split of months that gives the most stable distributions. Add to that, you've got problems of the temperature shifting over time. So here we've got the changes in temperature over time for Sydney and Melbourne. You can see the blue lines there. They've shifted significantly. So the red bars are up to 1970 for Sydney and up to 1990 for Melbourne. And the blue bars are since then. They're roughly, the sample sizes in both are roughly similar. And you can see in both have seen significant shifts towards hotter overall average temperatures, meaning that we're going to need to put linear trends into this. Here we just wanted to highlight, when you look into the tail in Melbourne, you can see the top 10 results, probably by counts there, have all been within the last 20 years. Particularly that 38.5 that was last year, average temperature throughout the day. That's averaging your max and your min was 38. And that's a significant outlier when you look at the sorts of data points that are involved in these. And then you've got your volatility, which doesn't sit still. And this is a common problem in financial markets, but it's, again, another variable, another estimation of parameters that needs to be involved. So just quickly skip on to putting this into a pricing example. And here I've priced a CCD option, CDD option, which is a cumulative degree day. It's a typical temperature derivative, priced it using a few different methods. And it's based on Sydney Airport contract with a $100,000 tick. And I won't have a lot of time to go into this, but I'll just show you the types of results you get using the different techniques. So the blue line there is a burn analysis, the pink line is a Monte Carlo simulation, and the red is a normal approximation. And they're quite similar in terms of their approaches, but of course once you get out to large exercise prices and you get large volatilities in your normal distribution factors inside your option pricing model, they start to differ significantly, with a normal approximation being significantly more expensive. I've only got a couple minutes left to allow some questions, so I'll just quickly talk about carbon prices, which I haven't had enough time to talk about. But here's the carbon prices collapsing GFC. Market stabilised since then. This is up to April this year, so we're seeing some recent signs of recovery. Significant volatility, though, particularly throughout the end of last year and into this year, and you can see several spikes there. One of the major problems with this was in April 06, and this is due to, you know, it's an inefficient market. We've got informational inefficiencies, and this is what happened when the market suddenly got reported and discovered that it was way too long, and that happened in the space of two trading days. The price collapsed it halved. And these types of things make pricing of derivatives very difficult, and means that you can't use your standard Black-Scholes frameworks, and you need to incorporate jumps into your models. So just to finish up, the securitisation markets, particularly carbon and weather markets, are expanding. The types of contracts are expanding. The types of variables that exist and that are reported are expanding. The types of derivatives we see over those variables, they're incorporating both more variables and different types of structures to help offload these risks. There's been a huge interest from hedge funds and other specialist asset managers in terms of using these as a diversification tool. And you know, given that we've learned quite a lot of lessons out of the securitisation of these assets and the collateralisation of the risks and the liabilities involved, seeing through those problems and establishing, I guess, a new framework for increasing the reliability of these products, we should see, you know, the next couple of years the securitisation of insurance risks and the ILS market in general to expand significantly. Thank you.
Thanks, John. If anyone's got any questions, they can. If they put their hand up, I'll bring the microphone over. Well, John, I might just kick it off. Yep. You know, I guess one interesting thing with the interest rate markets is, as you know, some of the markets become less liquid, or there's more people trying to buy protection than sell protection, that can impact the prices. Just wondering, for some of these, even these, some of these frequently traded derivatives like the weather, you know, temperature ones and the carbon ones, you know, how much of those prices, do they move away from those fair values shown by some of those techniques? And are people using those techniques when there's, you know, a limited number of protection buyers or protection sellers out there to provide that liquidity and depth?
Yeah, I'd say it's particularly to do with the protection buyers. They're the ones who tend to dry up the most quickly when the market gets in trouble. I think, you know, for example, when Lehman's failed, all of the major US institutions were internally banned from any new issues in the ILS or cat bond market. So I see it really as the risk takers who abandon the market first, and then I guess that flows on. Once that capacity is not there, then they, I guess, the people trying to transfer the risk have to return to these traditional insurance and reinsurance markets. So it's very cyclical, and it's, I guess, one of the problems that the alternative risk transfer market faces, that it only comes into favour every 4 or 5 years, in particular when we get these capacity constraints and when we see the risk takers abandon the market. It's a very cyclical thing. It would be nice to think that it's got a continuous place in the market, but at the moment it tends to be in and out of favour every few years.
Mm. All right, has that jogged anyone's? I can. are there any other factors that have caused the volume of weather derivatives contracts to be so volatile in recent years?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'd just probably take you back to the point I made, which just the definition changes, and I guess this is due to them being immature, incomplete markets. Again, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is still trying to grasp the best way to list these types of products, and they had listed them on annual basis, and they went to a bi-monthly basis, and then it went to a monthly basis, and so these a lot of the variation you're seeing in the types of contracts here are due to these are total notional amounts here, so that's a notional outstanding. It's not a true volume measure of premium that's been exchanged. So a lot of these figures are dependent on the types and the time spans that these contracts cover, and they've gone from covering long periods of time to significantly shorter periods of time. So that's caused a bit of, I guess that would be what I would take out of 2008 being significantly more than 07. I'd say 07, 09 is probably where we should see the market achieve in 2010, and hopefully upwards from there.
Thanks, Juan. Good to have at least one question from the floor.
I just want to, just interested to know who, in a practical sense, buy these derivatives. And so I'm thinking of, you know, people who run holidays, you know, travel, the travel insurance industry, travel industry, farmers, those people, airlines. Is that the sort of people that the
yeah, look, I could spend,
buy them?
I've given a talk on weather derivatives before where I spent the whole hour talking about the people who can use it. And, you know, we're quite slow here to pick up on the applications of these weather contracts. Agriculture is a natural one, and the government's got a few programs looking into how weather derivatives can help us, particularly after going through the longest drought in 100 years. But really anywhere. I mean, contracts in the States, there's... I could give you numerous examples, snowmobile manufacturers and people like that buying weather derivatives because they'll sell their snowmobiles, and if there's a bad season, they don't sell as much. Some, there's even a record of they give away, you buy a snowmobile or I don't know what the term is for them properly, but and they would give you a 50% off that if there wasn't X amount of snowfall in that particular year. Tourism has massive applications. The construction industry, it's something that's sort of close to my heart, is significantly affected by the weather, and they don't really price weather in a very sophisticated manner in construction companies in Australia. And it's my dad was actually ran a construction company for many years, and he always used to just put 10% on top and didn't really matter where it was. That was just the practice, and when you're tendering for jobs, it was understood that everyone was putting 10% on for weather. But in the US, I guess they're more readily adoptive of these types of practices, and they realise, well, if I'm just going to add 10% on, why don't I pay 6% to have that risk transferred, and then I can be more competitive on my tender. But the applications are enormous, yeah.
So it's just lack of sophistication then that we don't have it.
I think so, and we're not... I think we lag the market in our sophistication, definitely.
Any last questions? Would you please... We actually did run out of time, so I did have one thing that just sort of tweaked my mind then was, you know, with the US markets and regulations attempting to improve clearing houses and margining for some of these, you know, derivatives, will that happen with these as well?
Well, I think that's the fallout from the GFC, and that's the benefit we're going to get from these types of market upheavals, and that's what's come out. It took probably all of the rest of last year to sort out a new framework for dealing in insurance securitisations, and as I say, anecdotally, they seem to have sorted that out amongst the counterparties, and they're now, ready to put new issues onto the market. So,
okay, Well, that was a fantastic presentation and paper. So will you please join me in thanking John?